This is Mark McNeese, and you're listening to One Thing or Another, Interviews and Conversations. Welcome to the podcast. This is your host, Mark McNeese, and my guest today is Angelica Herrera-Vinson, the head of CAPAC Aging and Caregiving Resources. Angelica has worked in the field of aging in diverse communities for about 2 decades. Her training is in epidemiology and public health with a focus on aging. Angelica is a former professor and academic and has researched and published articles on related topics, including the quality of care of diabetes, depression in older age, health disparities among Hispanic and other minority elders, and family caregiving challenges in vulnerable populations. Angelica, how are you today?
I'm doing great this morning. Thank you, Mark, for having me.
My pleasure. Now, just give people some information about you, where you live, and because we had a little time zone to figure out here, and some information on who you are.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, Arizona is a little tricky in that sense, is that we don't change time zones at all. but I'm here in the Chandler, Arizona area. I live here with my husband and my 5-year-old daughter. But I have lived in many corners of the country throughout my personal and professional life. I did actually grow up in San Diego near the U.S.-Mexico border, and this was back in the 80s when, let me date myself, but back then, you know, people moved very freely between the two countries, and I've lived in Mexico for about 7 years and have also lived in Houston, Washington, D.C., New York. It's been fun times, and I was in the D.C. area during the time that I was completing a health and aging policy fellowship. And then in Baltimore, in the Baltimore area, when I was, you know, doing my, some of my academic training and was teaching and doing my research over at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. But, you know, professionally, I do consider, just like you said, I do consider myself to be a gerontologist. Many people don't know what on earth that is, but it is a person who is in a profession that's focused on older adults or, you know, on the study of aging. So it could be someone in, you know, nursing, a social worker. For me, that passion was public health. So, you know, I do have my master's and doctorate in public health. And but I started off really working on the front lines in community health, went on to work in academia, you know, doing my research. And I did eventually leave academia. You know, it's great to publish, but, you know, I don't like work just sitting on, you know, the bookshelves or now, you know, in an online expensive repository of academic journals. So I did end up moving to an organization, the National Council on Aging, soon after I left academia. And it was an amazing ride. Really, it's a very reputable nonprofit organization that's working to help vulnerable seniors, help promote, you know, policy across the board. So it's been, you know, fantastic. And I, as I mentioned, I did start off in the community with community health centers. I taught everything from, you know, around HIV/AIDS prevention, healthy eating to migrant farm workers. This was like in Southern California. Many of the farm workers, you know, obviously had very limited, you know, resources. We also provided, you know, education and support to mostly migrant workers who were actually in San Diego, in that San Diego rural area at the time, who were tending to horses that, you know, raced on the racetrack. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they too, their living conditions were awful. So some of, you know, our support was in the form of, here's how to clean your water. Yeah. So it's, yes. And then so thereafter, in New York City, I had the opportunity to work at the NYU Cancer Center for Immigrant Health. I know that at some point they later moved to Sloan Kettering, but, you know, we supported a cancer care and prevention, a number of research projects, but that involved a lot of, you know, extensions into community work. I think that's where, you know, being raised, you know, mostly, you know, Mexican-American, it was my first true kind of multicultural experience, where you really cannot, you know, when one size does not fit all, and you really had to tailor, we really had to tailor our approach to our education, our research, everything for each of the, you know, the 6 or 8 communities that we were working with. It was absolutely, you know, exciting. But we worked with Haitian, Dominican, Mexican, Korean, Chinese, I mean, a number of other immigrant groups. All around, you know, kind of cancer prevention work. And, you know, as I mentioned, you could not take one approach and then dump it into another community. And that has been the basis, too, of like I work now on the Kapok, side and those resources. But, you know, for example, you could not go into a Korean community, you know, if you didn't have a white coat and a professional title. You would not be taken seriously.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and if you know, we had 2 female Korean social workers who were completely fluent in Korean. It did not matter to do all the negotiations on collaborations, partnerships. We had to take, it was our lead doctor, Caucasian, white, who was the person who had to make those negotiations. So it was very different. Of course, in the Latino community, you know, it was a little easier, you know, for some of our team members. You know, we had to, you know, obviously we were able to break the language barrier, I'm fluent in Spanish. But, you know, as long as we made ourselves present, you know, we had a couple of meals, you know, with some of the senior staff in our community-based organizations, and thereafter, you know, the doors open. You know, once you have that, that friendship, that open communication, I could get them on board with almost any initiative. Hey, we're sending out we need your support letter on this. Can I get that signed? Sure, okay. Everything was just went faster once we had, you know, had formed those solid, you know, partnerships. But again, you know, it was very different. And I remember also we were working with a group of mostly Jamaican women. And, you know, we were on the subject of, you know, prostate cancer. And, you know, and obviously in this, you know, in my line of work around, you know, health education and what have you, you always have to consider, you know, what are some deep-seated misconceptions or myths or views about why someone gets a condition or a disease, right? You know, with Alzheimer's, for example, since there's very common belief that that deterioration and cognitive decline is normal, right? But we know obviously that that's not the case. And then with prostate cancer, there was a very deep-seated belief that prostate cancer is something that happened to men because they were, you know, philanderers and because they were promiscuous. Mm. And at that time, I remember, you know, I was out there giving a, you know, little pep talk on, you know, getting their husbands to be screened for prostate cancer and what have you. And around that time, Rudy Giuliani had just been diagnosed. And I use him as an example. And that was my mistake because they were quick to shoot me down and say, oh, well, you know why he got, the prostate cancer because, you know, he was, you know, philandering. And so on. So I kind of learned my lesson there, you know. But you have to always be aware of these, you know, kind of beliefs and misconceptions and address them, you know, head on. But sometimes you don't know what those are until you've spent enough time in, you know, different minority communities. And of course, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask you to, start to ask you about Kapok.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what inspired you to start that? And also, if you could explain the name for listeners.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, very much, you know, same reason you may have started, your blog is that you saw a niche. You saw a gaping hole of information. And, you know, I know that there is a lot of literature, a lot of, caregiving, excellent caregiving, you know, guidebooks, blogs, websites out there and organizations devoted to family caregiving. But I saw nothing that really spoke to some of the unique challenges that, a lot of, you know, first generation and immigrant and minority communities in particular were facing. And so, so that's where initially my website actually started off as a resource for my students. And then, you know, then once I left academia, kind of switched gears and kind of redirected its focus, you know, for that reason.
What's the name mean? Tell people what the name
Yeah,
or the name is.
kapok. Yeah, no, so kapok is it's another word for the ceiba tree, and the ceiba tree, it's the sacred tree of the Maya. And so that's, Mayan is where I have my indigenous roots, but the ceiba tree is, in Mayan mythology, it really is that the tree of life, the sense that the roots are in the underworld, top of the tree is, kind of facing upward toward the heaven. But it also, kind of reminds me of, that sense of how throughout life, we really have this, we start, we end up where we started in a way. And life is this, kind of a progression of many life events and accumulation of, all the good and bad that happens in our lives. In fact, in gerontology now, we have there's more focus on looking at aging, from the life course perspective, right? That, it's when you're studying aging, it's not just like, we can't just truncate, at 55 and say these are seniors and this is the group I'm going to focus on, but that how a person, grows old, and what their old age may look like is going to, depend heavily on how they manage everything in their life. Now, of course, a great deal of that will be truly, environmental and out of their hands. But there's much that they can also, change. A person who obviously, for example, mismanaged their money, or who, scared away every friend or family, and those are individuals who, in their older age, might have less friends or family around them, or who may, struggle financially to meet their long-term care needs because they never took a moment to really step back and manage, their finances. And again, that's their behaviors alone aren't going to dictate, their old age entirely, but people have more control over how they grow old than they truly do.
Now, how do you decide what topics you and your team are write about? Because they're on your site, there are a lot of articles. And how do you come up with what you want to write about?
Yes. And part of it is it's a balancing act, because there's going to be things that we want to write about that nobody else, that we suspect, okay, nobody's going to care about this, but we know that our readers should be informed on this, and we have to find very creative ways of inserting those important bits of information into other, more exciting topics. But we do our research. We, of course, have a number of tools at our disposal to look at, what's trending, what are people searching for. But also, we're on, dozens of different caregiving forums, and so we're always keeping an ear out for what people are looking for and what are some of the challenges that family caregivers are facing. But most importantly, now that we have, more of a readership, we get emails. So we get emails, we get questions, comments. So we also look at the track record of existing articles, and we start to see a trend. We notice, that there's definitely a lot of interest in articles on, how to deal with difficult parents, how to have that difficult conversation about finances. What happens if I don't want to or can't care for my aging parent, et cetera. So all those, we start to see a trend, and like, okay, there's a pattern there, and we look at, what aspects of that issue is not kind of fully covered. So, Kathy Green, who's our content developer and really manages the kind of ins and outs on a day-to-day basis of the website, and myself, we're we research. We're very much into the data, the numbers, and so we're constantly keeping track of what new research is out there, and as much as and so making sure that really our readers are getting the latest and greatest. So that's definitely one. But we did take a deep dive, like maybe in middle of 2019, to just take a step back and make sure that we were still staying true to what the intended goal of the website was. That we were covering, you know, even as we planned out, you know, the timeline of our calendar of when, of what was going to be posted and when, that we were covering topics like in a good rotation, you know, that we had central themes around aging in place, around, the multicultural, challenges that there were, we saw there was a lot of interest in food. We're trying to, there always is, right? We need to eat. And so that there's, a lot of interest in how do you find the right assisted living, is it the right time, and all these issues, kind of making sure that they're we're providing enough of the content. And one thing we saw a huge deficit in what the content was around finances. So we've really made a big push to bring in more articles, more information on the finances. So we did a whole piece on the Social Security, and so it's really very responsive, but very much we do our research.
Yeah, I could see that. And a little earlier, you talked about cultural differences, that there are always going to be cultural differences with whatever group that you're working with. And you talked about that. Are there some common threads that apply across cultures in terms of caregiving and working mm-hmm. with older people?
Yes. Yeah. So the money is a big one. Is how will I finance this? Because most of America does not have the savings or the finances to really cover the kind of long-term care that we may need, after the age of 65 and 70. So, a large, portion of us will need some care at some point, and it could be even short-term where, after a stroke, after a hospital, after a fall, and you may even require that short term intensive rehabilitation and kind of home care. And few people have saved enough. At the National Council on Aging, we often talked about the one away from a crisis, and that could be that. It is just that one hospitalization where now you're really left, with nothing, and your every last bit of your Social Security or your pension is going to pay off that that last hospital bill. So so again, even if people think they have some, it's usually going to be really zapped up in that first crisis. So there's a lot. So that's a very important common thread, is that. Is that financial piece, especially, on who does that financial obligation, fall upon? And that's where we do see some cultural differences in that, more recent minority immigrants and minorities tend to take on more of the financial burden, mm-hmm. Than their parents. But still, it's a common issue, definitely across the board, the financial challenges.
And I see, I work, and I'm retiring from full-time work in April. I'm still going to work part-time for the extra money and the socialization. But I've seen mm-hmm. many older workers, lots of them, who keep working because they have to. They're collecting Social Security. But a shocking number of Americans rely mm-hmm. on Social Security as their sole income. Yeah. And so they end up working in grocery stores or wherever they can work. I mean, I was working with a gentleman, a very nice guy. He just turned 80 yesterday, or it was his birthday. He's working because he has to. And he's going to work until he dies on the job. I don't know, but it's not a good situation for an awful lot of older Americans.
No, you hit it right on the nail. And it's actually a topic we recently published a piece that we have one that's just, your guide really to managing and getting set up and understanding, the basics of Social Security. But we recently published another piece that speaks to what you're talking about. And that's, just understanding the fact that the vast number, of older adults, will rely on only Social Security as their primary source of income. And so how do you avoid that? And but we have a number of pieces too where we talk about the workforce. How do you decide on whether to keep a part-time job, and also what impact does that have on your Social Security earnings? And you want to manage that carefully, that you work one more hour than is your max, and then boom, you get, you know, a slice cut from your torso. So it's a balancing act. But you know, we also speak to, just like you said, there's social benefits of and health benefits of continuing to work and staying active and staying connected to others. So it is, you know, because even people who don't have to work, right, you know, like you said, they will choose to work for sometimes for that reason. But it's getting, you know, folks set up to really manage the, you know, the coming, you know, onslaught of, you know, caregiving expenses and, you know, personal expenses. And of course, we always tried on our site, and really focus it on the, you know, from the caregiver's perspective. And, you know, I don't think I've even mentioned this so far, but I actually just finished a book. it's actually the Multicultural Guide to Caregiving. It's basically done. My publisher and editor, she's based out of Louisiana, and right now she had to evacuate. So hopefully, oh, wow, once she gets back, you know, yeah, we're going to go ahead and move forward with getting, you know, just the cover done and getting it ready for publication. But it is ready, and one of the key things, a major focus of that book is, you know, the importance of looking at, if you're a caregiver, you know, the same idea that when you're you know, the airplane's going down, you know, you got to give yourself oxygen first before you can help somebody else. And, you know, you know, our tendency, and sometimes, you know, the sense of guilt and obligation to care for an aging relative, a parent or otherwise, you know, you start to shell out money, and you know, without having a hard look at your own financial plan. You know, what does your own budget look like? Can you afford that? And especially, you know, those like that are in my, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and, you know, many, you know, men and women in my age group, you know, if you are doing financially okay, you might feel that, I can, you know, shell this out for these services or home care or whatever, but that will add up. And what about your own retirement? And what about your own savings? What about paying off that house, you know, or those student loans? And so it, you know, I talk a lot about that in my book and on the side, is how to juggle that, because, you know, and as I mentioned, you know, there are definitely those distinctions in different, you know, cultural groups. I know Chinese parents, I know that a lot of Chinese, you know, adult children say that they feel a strong sense of financial obligation to totally, you know, cover every 100% of the cost of their aging parent. That's a little bit more so than I see in with other, you know, communities. But it's a burden. And then when for more, you know, recently immigrated, you know, minorities, or who still have, maybe they may be doing long distance caregiving, and, you know, they're sending, you know, remittances back to their aging parent in their home country. You know, how do they do that safely, and how much can they actually, you know, spend without exhausting their own, you know, their own resources? And it gets tricky too. So that's one of the things we talk about too on the side, but also in my book, is just how to do that safely, because you're also sending money to a vulnerable senior in another country. And, you know, for some of us that, you know, that come from a country where that's a developing nation, I know, let me say straight out, but in Mexico, you really want to be careful. You don't want your grandmother or aging relative to get, you know, swindled, or have, you know, all of their resources, you know, robbed, because the system is crooked. So these are things that we talk about, and those are considerations that, you know, most of us growing up here in the U.S. might not even take into consideration. But those, you know, some of our readers who are, you know, involved in a lot of international caregiving, it's a lot of money spent too, just traveling back and forth, you know, across the seas, or, you know, across the borders, and, you know, trying to keep an eye out, you know, for those family members, making sure that they're in a safe space, you know, that they aren't, you know, taken advantage of. It's really very tough.
Now, I had one more question before we wrap up. It has to do, initially, I was thinking about asking you about some apps, but more broadly speaking, because I also think that there's a lack of access to internet access for income levels too. It's not just elderly people, but why are older people technologically challenged. I'm 62. I'm not a young thing, but I'm technically very savvy. So I sometimes I wonder, like, why is it a resistance to technology, or I don't quite understand why. It's also assumed. It's assumed that if you're older, you don't know how to turn on a phone, which is, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And two very different issues. You know, one is that is the access issue. The other is the familiarity with the technology and just the overall, literacy. So if we're, I 62, very young, right? And I mean, I I'm in my mid-40s and I have, I'm technologically challenged, here and there. But I know the stats are anywhere from, they say at least 50% of seniors, do have a smartphone and are, connected. But these surveys, some are from Gallup and other, kind of reputable sources. The challenge is that even those, and I know AARP has done a few studies and surveys on, the use of, technology. And it's always a matter of getting down into the weeds, is that there are certain things that seniors, are going to be comfortable with, using technology for, going to the ATM, for example, to withdraw money. Some people are comfortable with, social media and, Facebook, but it's, now programming your television, that's a whole nother, that's actually on the high end of complexity, believe it or not. Yeah. we have found that, there are proven strategies for how to get older adults comfortable with all levels of technology. We actually just published a piece on this. I think it's called Tutoring Technology for Seniors. It's a piece I wrote, and it's kind of a high-level overview, a few steps, the do's and don'ts on how to work with an older adult to get them comfortable with the technology. And, some of the basic things that we forget from, the repetition, from leaving some kind of laminated, step-by-step with pictures, everything, that they can easily refer to. So those things help that older adult to really become comfortable and confident that they can, use the technology. That said, it's really important. We have to bridge that digital divide. There's a number of, great tools and resources are absolutely helpful. You have a lot of great medication management applications online. My go-to that I always recommend is that MyFitnessPal. It's a free tool.
Oh, yeah.
Great way to, right. It's free. I always love the free ones convenient ones. But those happen to be, apps that are always useful. The other that I know a lot of older adults get into is, games, online games. And that's totally fine, but as long as they're not under the impression that those applications, they have some that are, brain training games and memory games. The truth of the matter is that there is not enough research to show that those are really effective. That where there is a little bit of research is when you are referring to those, those games that are, I think they call them like Xer games, where let's say I'm thinking like the Wii console, where you're doing a little bit of, physical activity, but it's part of, it's kind of gamified. That there's research that it may help with some kind of mild cognitive impairment. But even that, the lack of quality studies out there is really, it's the big issue. So it's not something that people should not go into these games or pay lots of money for, those thinking that it's going to keep, it's going to stave off, dementia or Alzheimer's. No, that's always going to be, improve your diet, get screened early and regularly. But the games alone won't definitely do that. And I know that, we were talking earlier about just the digital divide. It's something true that, it may not be a resistance to having smartphones or using those, but merely just as an access issue. I know that with our community health centers that serve here in Arizona. In my current day job, I support, you know, quality improvement for, it's a network of 7 community health centers where we're, you know, pushing the Medicaid value-based, you know, contracting and, you know, and management. But our health centers, especially during COVID, I mean, they really had to totally, you know, change the way that they, you know, saw patients. And many of them are serving older adults in rural areas or in American Indian on reservations in the area. And, you know, often some of the tricks that they had was to allow to distribute tablets to seniors, especially, you know, older adults that may have had multiple chronic conditions and they knew they were at risk and wanted to keep a closer eye on. So they gave them tablets. They kind of had to walk them through how to use those. And then sometimes, because, you know, broadband is very limited in these rural areas, they had to they would invite the seniors or whoever was driving them to come to the health center, stay in the parking lot, and do the virtual visit, you know, from the parking lot. Because and they had to find that workaround. So yeah, sometimes, you know, it's not even a matter of can they get familiar with the technology, but it's that access. So, you know, that definitely is changing, and hopefully if, you know, oh my God, what is the name from, not from, Amazon, we will have, broadband, you know, worldwide, soon enough. And I think, you know, in a matter of a few years, I think that is possible. And if we get there, that'll certainly go a long way.
Well, Angelica, it's been really nice to talk to you and learn more about what you do. How can people, what's the URL, what's the website address for people to go to find CAPAC?
Yes. Okay, great. Yeah, the name is multiculturalcaregiving.net.
Also, they can also, I think they can Google K-A-P-O-C. They'll find you, but that's your URL.
Yes.
And there's...
right,
and that's... a lot of good articles there. I highly recommend that people check the site out. Your content is excellent. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a delight to talk to you. I love your energy.
Likewise. Oh, my God. Well, you keep up your great work. And, you know, my best wishes to you and your listeners. And hope to, you know, hear from some of them.
All right. Well,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day. This is Mark McNeese, and you've been listening to One Thing or Another, Interviews and Conversations.